One of the constant themes in these lectures has been the alternation between the public and the private. For example, in the last lecture, we were in the circle of the sun, and there Dante meets the great sages of the biblical Christian tradition, and the masters of ceremony for that circle for Dante are Thomas Aquinas and Bonaventure, both of whom have remained as kind of examples of Christian philosopher theologians. So they have a kind of public fame that has continued from Dante's time until our own. But in the next circle, Dante's next stop in his celestial voyage, he encounters a figure who has a much more private kind of resonance with him. He meets his own great-great-grandfather, a person named Cacciaguida. We're in the circle of Mars. The virtue associated with the circle of Mars turns out to be courage, as wisdom was the virtue for the circle of the sun. And unlike the circle of the sun, where Dante was literally surrounded by 24 of the most important sages in Christian history, in the circle of Mars, several cantos are devoted to a kind of dialogue back and forth between Dante and his own ancestor. And really, those are the only two actors on the scene at this point. So what we're going to try and do is to move through the circle of Mars in this lecture and talk a little bit about why this encounter is so important for the pilgrim on so many different levels.
It's a long and sustained encounter, and it begins, as Dante the poet narrates it, this way. With like affection did Anchises' shade rush forth, if we may trust our greatest muse, when in Elysium he beheld his son. So the introduction to this meeting of ancestor and descendant is, by analogy, the meeting of Virgil's characters, Aeneas, with his father Anchises in the Aeneid Book 6. And so it's an interesting way we go back to a Virgilian image as a way of Dante beginning his story. And then, in fact, when Cacciaguida speaks, he speaks his first few lines in Latin, very unusual. And also the first three words, O sanguis meus, are, in fact, a quotation from the Aeneid Book 6. Oh, my blood, is the way he begins. Now, Dante doesn't know who's talking to him at this time. It takes a while for that to unfold. But here in this very dramatic moment, we have this Virgilian overtone.
A couple of things to say about that. First is that Dante, the poet, is clearly trying to capture that sense of Virgilian pietas, the loyalty between generations that is so manifest in the fact that Aeneas takes a trip to the underworld to see his father. But it's also important that the purpose for that trip, as far as Aeneas is concerned, is to find out an answer to the question, why go on? What's the point of it all? And in some ways, this is a what's the point of it all canto for the pilgrim as well. Because here, more than any other place in the entire Commedia, we deal with Dante's mission as a poet, his vocation as a poet, and also we deal head on with the question of his exile. And all of those are put together, are woven together in this encounter that goes on through several cantos between Dante and his great-great-grandfather.
In Canto 15, Dante picks up his inquiry as to who exactly this is this way. I too, as man, feel this disparity deeply, so only with my heart can I give thanks for your paternal welcome here. A line that's reminiscent of, oddly enough, Inferno 15, where Dante talks about a paternal relationship, as does the person he's talking to. If you recall, that is the sodomite Brunetto Latini. And we talked about how Brunetto uses that language in a kind of artificial way. Here, this is the real thing. This is indeed a relationship between, at least metaphorically, father and son. I beg of you, rich topaz, living gem within the setting of this precious jewel, to satisfy my wish to know your name. And Cacciaguida answers this way. Branch of my tree, the mere expectancy of whose arrival here gave me delight, I was your root. He begins now a process of identifying himself more generally as an ancestor, and then ultimately he will also tell us his name.
And in fact, in this canto, what he does is sort of tell his identity by telling the early history of Florence, pretty much up to the time of his own death. And what he mostly is interested in talking about is the moral virtue that Florence once had in the good old days. The implicit comparison, of course, is between that good time and the factionalism that is essentially splitting the city now. And so he talks about what it was like in the good old days and what those qualities, what those particular virtues were, which were responsible for a city which one would be, as Cacciaguida clearly is, proud to have lived in.
For example, he says, Florence, enclosed within her ancient walls, from which she still hears terse and nones ring out, once lived in peace, a pure and temperate town. No necklace or tiara did she wear, no lavish gowns or fancy belts that were more striking than the woman they adorned. Dante here recognizes the fact that between Cacciaguida's time, he dies around 1150, and Dante's time, poem set in 1300, Florence has changed radically. Even if you go to Florence today, when you're right in the center of Florence, all the streets are at right angles to one another, because that's the old Roman city, and that's the way Romans laid out things, and that was the ancient wall around Florence. But shortly after the time of Cacciaguida, Florence began to expand rapidly, and as it did, it grew out beyond that set of walls to another set of walls, till still another set that were being built in Dante's own time. And with that rapid building, it also meant that no longer all the streets laid out, but rather, again, even today, when you walk outside the very center core of Florence, the streets start wandering every which way. And I think for Dante, that was both a sign and a symbol of the fact that Florence had become so complex and so chaotic. People had moved into Florence from all kinds of different places, bringing with them various local traditions, ways of doing things, ways of operating. And that complexity was a great problem for Florence in Dante's day. I think that there is a little bit of nostalgia here for the good old days before urban sprawl, if you will, but it's much more than that. He's looking for what made our city united. How can we go back and find a time when the city worked together? Well, it was a time when there was order, literal physical order. Also, it was a time before avarice took over. Women did not wear fancy clothes. Men did not build houses bigger than they needed to live in. So although there is a kind of nostalgic touch to this, it's much more than that. Dante is trying to find and then hopefully reclaim a moment of Florentine unity, order, simplicity.
One way to take a look at it is to see it as a kind of urban pastoral. This is Little House on the Arno. It's within that context that Cacciaguida then goes from Florence to himself. In other words, until he has situated Florence, he can't begin to talk about who he is. That sense of identity through Florence, which of course is particularly interesting in the light of the fact that these are the cantos that are also going to predict Dante's own exile from Florence. But in any case, he talks about himself and says that within your ancient baptistry, a Christian I became, and Cacciaguida. Okay, in other words, he was named at that point. The naming here, I think, in the baptistry, I think is an important thing. Dante obviously plays around with names a great deal throughout the Commedia. This is one where I think it's really worthwhile taking a look at it etymologically speaking. Cacciaguida is the guide, the guida, for the hunt, the caccia, the chase. And it seems to me that in a way, that's kind of the role that he's going to play in Dante's life from here on, in that he is serving as a guide for this hunt that Dante himself is going to embark on. Another way of thinking about his exile is going to be Dante hunted out of Florence. And what Cacciaguida really has to teach Dante is to become the hunter rather than the hunted. And he's a good guy to do this because he tells us, when I was born in Florence, I was baptized. And then he jumps to what was the part of his life which got him here. That is to say, he became a crusader, and when he was off on a crusade, he was killed, and therefore he achieved a kind of martyrdom. and came immediately to this point.
I want you to think for a minute about the importance of him being a crusader. First of all, a crusader under whom? He was a member, we're told, of the Second Crusade that was called around the middle of the 12th century. By the way, just sort of file this away for future reference. The main figure that was behind the calling of that crusade was a Cistercian monk named Bernard of Clairvaux. File that away. At any rate, it's the Emperor Conrad who leads this crusade. Here's an emperor of Rome fighting against the enemies of Christendom as they were understood at that time. Here's an emperor doing what an emperor should do. Here's a citizen doing what a citizen should do. This was a time when things worked locally in Florence. This was a time when things worked universally in the time of the empire. And Dante, therefore, is contextualizing Florence once again in the empire. He starts with Florence and goes to empire, while in the discussion of Justinian, he started with empire and made a reference to Florence. So there's this interweaving of the local and the universal.
Canto 15 ends, in fact, with Cacciaguida's martyrdom. And, of course, just to sort of state the obvious, that's what guarantees his place in the Circle of Mars. Remember, the virtue there is courage, fortitude. So as a crusader, he is on the red planet. And, in fact, we are told that when Dante gets there, he sees that the planet is sort of bisected with a kind of crusader's cross. The next canto begins with Dante reflecting on what he has just heard, and basically saying it's almost impossible for him not to take pride in what he has heard about his ancestor. He says, "Ah, trivial thing, our pride in noble blood, that you can make men glory in you here on earth where our affections are weak-willed, will never again amaze me, for up there, where appetite is always in the right in heaven, I gloried in my blood." Now, that's a really interesting passage to kind of unpack, because remember, when we were back in Inferno 10, it was all of that pride in ancestry which was really responsible in a very real way for what happens in all of the factionalism in Florence. Is Dante here forgetting the lesson that he has learned up until this time? Has he, you know, has it not made any kind of impression on him when he's saying, boy, am I lucky to have had an ancestor like him? But notice what he says immediately after. He says, "Nobility, a mantle quick to shrink unless we add to it from day to day." And I think what he's saying there is that, again, this image of nobility is a kind of garment that you put on. It doesn't stay on, or it shrinks and is the wrong size unless your own actions add to it. In other words, what he's saying, very important, is that Cacciaguida's model is something to take pride in only to the extent that it is a spur to one's own similar deeds. And so what it does is kind of raise the question here, which is going to be the question of the rest of this circle. What can I do in my time as a kind of imitation of what my ancestor did in his? And so you see that here, this canto goes, Cacciaguida ended with his death. Now, this canto takes the historical narrative and goes from Cacciaguida's time all the way to Dante's.
Let me suggest you one of the ways that he describes the change that takes place between, again, around 1150 and Dante's time. "Oh, happy wives," he says about the good old days. "Each one of them was sure of her last resting place. None of them yet lay lonely in her bed because of France." It's a very interesting line. Family stayed together, and families lived together, and they died together. Now, France takes its toll on Florence. What does Dante mean by that? Well, first of all, he's talking about greed. He's talking about avarice, because merchants went to France, especially to some of the great fairs in France, to buy goods to sell in Italy as a profit. So wives lost their husband to the fact that business, making a lot of money to build those big houses and buy those fancy clothes, that meant more than staying in Florence with family. But the other thing is, and this refers to the other main change, the change of political factionalism, when the Pope drove out Dante's party, the White Guelphs from Florence, he used French troops. He brought in the relatives of the French monarchy to actually do the military part of kicking out the White Guelphs. So France has led to both the greed and the political factionalism doing its bad stuff, if you will, so that Florence is a very different place. The city is divided, and notice how that trickles all the way down to the family is divided. This stuff all begins at the beginning with individuals and families, and it works its way all the way up, and conversely, what starts with the major policies of the world trickles all the way down. It works both ways.
Not surprisingly, then, when he moves to that history between his own time and the Pilgrim's time, one of the things that he zeroes in on are the events that in Florence actually began the struggle between Guelphs and Ghibellines. And he talks very specifically about an event that we have ourselves alluded to several times.
Interestingly enough, at least according to the way the Florentines told the story, there was one particular event that began the struggle between the Guelphs and the Ghibellines. There is a birthday moment. It's one we've referred to before, where a guy had a bride-to-be, and he ditched her for a better offer, and ultimately he was murdered. And that tension, that fighting, began the Guelph-Ghibelline conflict. Well, the guy who jilted his bride and the guy who was later killed was a guy named Buondelmonte. Now, as it turns out in the Guelph-Ghibelline story, he's the founder of the Guelphs. Okay, he's Mr. Guelph. And the guy who did the killing, a member of the Uberti family, Farinata's family, was sort of Mr. Prototype Ghibelline. Which one does Dante single out for condemnation here? He singles out the founder of his own party, Buondelmonte. Dante has to come to grips with the fact that it's not the black Guelphs who are the problem. It's not the Ghibellines who are the problem. It is political factionalism that is the problem. And his own party is equally responsible for the results of that factionalism, as is his opposite party, whether it's a faction of Guelphs in the new days or the Ghibellines in the old days.
We were talking at great length back in Inferno in that canto of factionalism about the factionalism between Farinata and Dante, that it sort of started in the past with Farinata ahead. It moved to the present with Dante getting the knockout punch because his party was in control. And then the kind of sucker punch that Farinata has, we move to the future as we have a prediction of Dante's own exile. Something like the same temporal pattern takes place here, only over a much wider canvas because it goes for three separate cantos. What we had first was Cacciaguida telling us about the early history of Florence, then bringing it up to the present, and now what you have sort of prepared the way for by that is the most sustained and the most important description of the future, that is to say, the future that is Dante's own exile. And Canto 17 of Paradiso starts with a description of that exile and moves to a very thoughtful discussion of what to do about it.
Basically, Dante says to Cacciaguida, you know, for a long time, people have been saying things sort of darkly, sort of obtusely about my future. Hasn't sounded real good. This began, by the way, all the way back in Inferno 6 is the first sort of muted prediction of Dante's exile. I've been collecting all this stuff that people have been saying. Can you tell me what it means? Can you put this together for me? Can you talk about the past? And by the way, they have a little conversation that says, if we can talk about what's going to happen to you in the future, it does not take away your responsibilities. It's not about a kind of fatalism. There is that conversation to precede this. But hey, Cacciaguida, what's going to happen to me?
Well, what's going to happen, of course, is exile, and we know that. But it's very interesting to see the very specific terms of exile as Cacciaguida describes it. And you get a sense for both the causes of it, which I think are interesting, but also the effects on Dante himself. That is to say, we're told about this exile in such a concrete and specific way that we really do get the sense of what personal privation it must have been for Dante. So he talks about the way it's going to happen by saying the following: so it is willed, so it is being planned and shall be done soon by the one who plots it there where daily Christ is up for sale. Well, again, here's our friend Boniface VIII. Where Christ is up for sale, of course, is Rome. This is another way of talking about the sin of simony. And as we've said so many times, it is Boniface's armies that are responsible for Dante's exile. But the problem with all of that, of course, is that when they do it, they also put out a pretty elaborate PR campaign to make sure that they look like the good guys. And so Cacciaguida continues, the public will, as always, blame the party that has been wronged. One of the problems is that in this case, history gets to be written by the winners, right? And of course, implicitly, one of the reasons why Dante gets to write the whole Commedia is to set that right. In a way, the comedy can be looked at as history written by one of the great losers, but of course, one of the great losers who turns it into a tremendous victory. Okay, he says, you shall be forced to leave behind those things you love most dearly, and this is the first arrow the bow of your exile will shoot. Again, you're away from home, probably for a good deal of that time from family as well. We don't really know quite as much as we would like about at what point or how often Dante was joined by family members in his exile, but there's reason to believe that, you know, folks had to stay behind to take care of things, and so Dante was probably for part of that time by himself. And then one of the great lines that describes exile, you will know how salty is the taste of others' bread, how hard the road that takes you down and up the stairs of others' homes.
Well, obviously, in a general sense, what he's saying is, you know, you're not going to have any more home cooking. That is to say, you're going to be at the beck and call of others. They're going to house you. They're going to feed you. And you're not going to have control. Things are not going to be familiar. But there's a particular reference here that's interesting. Even to this day, it is true that the Florentines do not put salt in their bread. And in fact, when Florentines go other places, it is still today one of the first things they remark about. How salty is this bread? It's a wonderful symbol because, of course, bread really is the staff of life. Bread has biblical Eucharistic significance, and you're going to be dependent on the bread of others, and you're going to be going up and down somebody else's stairs. What a powerful image of all the things you've taken for granted. Dante's lived in Florence 35 years at this time. All the things that simply have come to be taken for granted. All those things you sort of say, gee whiz, you know, I'm going to Rome on business, but I'll be back in 3 weeks. That's all gone. There is no Florence for him to come back to.
And notice that he's building up here, Cacciaguida. That's bad. That's very bad. But that's not the worst. What will weigh you down the most will be the despicable, senseless company whom you shall have to bear in that sad veil. And all ungracious, all completely mad and vicious, they shall turn on you. Well, we talked a little bit about that again when we were dealing with Farinata, who predicts that the art of coming back after exile is going to be the art that Dante finds very difficult to learn. Now we find another wrinkle, that it's hanging out with all of these sleazy political types who are scheming and wheeling and dealing to try and get back in, which is going to be something that is ultimately going to be a great humiliation to Dante. Who do you have to hang with in order to try and get back? And that's the question that Cacciaguida raises here. And so the answer of all of this, what Dante's going to have to do, it will be to your honor to have become a party of your own. In other words, you got to break out of this factionalism thing once and for all. And part of what Cacciaguida is saying to Dante is obviously an exhortation to do just that.
And you can imagine how this goes. Here are the white Guelphs. Dante's been in power himself in 1300 as one of the priors. And it's easy when you're in power to spout the rhetoric that says, we're doing this for Florence. This action is to make everything good. And then you end up in exile, and your buddies, the same guys, are sitting around saying, we'll do anything to drive those suckers out. We'll do anything. And that's where you discover what factionalism is about. It's not about getting control to do good. It's about getting control to do good for yourself. And Dante has to go through that bitter experience of failed attempts with a bunch of guys to get back into Florence to understand, as Ron just said, that it's not whether you're a white or a black. It's not whether you're a Guelph or a Ghibelline. You've got to break out of the whole mold of this is about me, this is about my party, as Farinata said.
And what Dante is able to place together here is the fact of exile and where he has just been on this journey. Sort of the light bulb goes off and he says, you know, I've been down all the way into the pits of hell and I've climbed the mountain of purgatory. And that means that I've seen things from a perspective that other people don't get to see. If I were to bring that back, all right, then I would be able to kind of make sense out of all of this to the people who are still involved in this fanatical kind of squabbling. And so isn't it a fact then that my job is to take this exile and to turn it into a kind of pilgrimage and therefore to tell others what I have learned? Now he says, that's a really cool thing and I think I'm going to do it, but problems involved in that because folks are not going to like what I have seen and heard and learned down here. And my job is going to be to tell it with all the force of an Old Testament prophet, even if it means getting people very, very angry at me. Well, he has one very great advantage, and that is that by doing this from the position of exile, he's doing it from the point of view of somebody who doesn't have very much to lose. Okay, so the very fact of his being in the position of exile allows him, like the Old Testament prophets, to speak with this extraordinary authority on what he has seen here.
And notice how he turns upside down what Brunetto Latini tried to teach him in Inferno 15 when Brunetto said, "You're right to become famous. Remember my tresor." Listen to what Dante says. "If I am a timid friend to truth, I fear my name may not live with those who will look back at these as the old days." In other words, he now understands if you write for fame, it doesn't last very long. If he's really going to do the right thing and write so that he has a greater presence in the world than just a flash of fame, he's got to tell the truth.
Notice also in that same set of passages, he uses another image about what telling the truth is all going to be about. He says, "I learned things that, were they to be retold, would leave a bitter taste in many mouths." Well, what he's doing then is feeding others salty bread, but he's feeding them salty bread, which is ultimately going to be great nourishment for them. And so the conditions of his own exile, you know, the fact that you can't eat the way you used to, all of those daily things that make it such a painful process turn out to be connected with the larger mission, okay, to go back and feed others. And if it's salty bread, it's certainly going to be good for them. So he sees that part of what he has to do is become a kind of apostle of truth. And in fact, he goes on to sort of get this from Cacciaguida, sort of agreeing with him, saying, the conscience that is dark with shame for his own deeds or for another's may well indeed feel harshness for your words. Now remember, what Cacciaguida is talking about, what words are these? The words are the poem that Dante the Pilgrim here is going to write, namely the Commedia itself. This is the best place in the poem, perhaps, the best place in the entire comedy to see the difference between pilgrim and poet. The pilgrim is learning here what the poet has put into practice in the very poem that we're reading. But then he goes on to say, "Though when your words are taken in at first, they may taste bitter, but once well digested, they will become a vital nutriment." So again, that whole image of feeding and food, which starts out with Dante's own deprivation, now moves to the nourishment of everybody who hears Dante's prophetic voice. And of course, it's also sort of interesting to just piggyback on one thing that Bill said. "I fear my name will not live on with those who will look back on these as the old days." Hey, that's us. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years have separated Dante's poem from us, but we still read this with profit because he heeded Cacciaguida's advice, because he wrote not for fame. The fame becomes a kind of interesting byproduct of what he's done.
I want to pick up on the notion of here Dante getting a prophetic commission. Very often, as we said way back at the beginning in our introductory lectures, it's easy to see prophets as people that just come in and shake their fingers a lot. But as Dante himself suggests here, there's more to it. If you look at the commission, for example, of Jeremiah, it is to tear down and to build up. The tearing down has to come first. But ultimately, a prophet is one who builds. The tearing down is to clear the way for a new structure. And that's what Dante will do. The words will be bitter, but they will become a vital nutriment. Dante has taken on the crusader mantle from his great-great-grandfather and the prophetic mantle all the way back to the Old Testament.
And of course, he learns that he has to be a crusader with the pen rather than with the sword.